Hello and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Punj. We are in the middle of a very heated election. Well, the results are not very far off. On June 4th, India will have a new government. India's aspirations have grown. India is pitching itself as the manufacturing destination to the world. One of the key ingredients to that is labor reforms. It's one of the most contentious issues that have been hanging on fire for a really, really long time. India has made some progress in streamlining its labor laws, doing away with certain redundant laws and compliances. But let me take you through some of the key numbers as of today. There are about 62,233 compliances for companies. There are 6,618 annual filings. This is the kind of compliance load that we are talking about, and labor makes up for about 40% of that compliance load. To understand in granular detail the importance of addressing these labor laws on priority, the importance of streamlining India's labor laws so that India's factories can upgrade themselves and pitch themselves as manufacturing destinations for the world, I have with me one of India's most erudite thought leaders in the regulatory space, Rishi Agarwal, co-founder and CEO for TeamLease RegTech. Thank you so much, Rishi. Just to give a little introduction of Rishi, Rishi has done some exhaustive work when it comes to research on compliances. It's been one of the issues that his organization has been raising consistently with the government and compiling and documenting the implications of these labor laws. And of course, I don't have to explain the importance of the enormity of these labor laws to all the business owners, whether small or big, or our startup founders who are dealing with this on a day in and day out basis. Thank you so much, Rishi, for joining us, and congratulations for putting together such an exhaustive paper. I know that TeamLease RegTech has been at the forefront of really compiling the kind of compliances that Indian businesses have to follow, and it's been quite a learning, actually. So, you know, let's begin with the recent white paper that came out around the 1st of May, which spoke about the number of compliances, which spoke about the number of annual filings. So if you could, you know, begin by putting this into perspective for us, even though we talk about ease of doing business and we have made progress, what is the kind of challenge that we are looking at right now?
Well, Shweta, thank you so much for having me on the show today. Really appreciate it. And thank you for a lovely and kind introduction. Let me start out by giving you a little bit of a context on the law of the land. Any business that wants to operate in India today operates in a regulatory ecosystem. The ecosystem at a high level has union laws, state laws, and local body regulations. If you put numbers around it, there are 1,536 unique acts and rules. Subsumed in them are 69,233 unique compliances and 6,618 unique filings across the law of the land. Now, one can argue that no single business has to deal with all of this. Absolutely. No single business has to deal with them. But the reality is a small MSME, and let me talk about manufacturing, dealing in automotive or pharmaceuticals or chemicals or any one of these manufacturing sectors, deals with anywhere between 600 to 1,000 unique compliances in a given year. When you look at the total compliances for such a company, they can go up to about 3,000 because there are multiple instances, there are monthly returns, there are quarterly returns, and so on and so forth. So when you do the math, the numbers can be anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 compliances in a year. On top of that, about 37% of these carry clauses for imprisonment going from 3 months to about 10 years. So if you look at the numbers, among the 69,233 that I mentioned earlier, 26,134 carry clauses for imprisonment. Recently, a Jan Vishwas bill went through the parliament and the number came down by about 183 clauses. And the number largely still is above 26,000. So that's a larger context. While the number of compliances are so many, one of the other bigger issues is these laws keep changing all the time. There are about 8,000 changes a year. These changes are not published on one website. These changes are published on 2,233 unique websites across union, state, and local body regulations. 437 union websites, 1,240 state websites, and I think 557 odd local body websites is where all these changes are published. Most of these websites are not very well designed. The regulatory update is not published on the homepage in majority of the cases. It is hidden 3 or 4 levels deep. In many cases, the pages become inaccessible. The document fails to load. The document is archived even before an employer got to it. There are local languages in the document. So somebody who is sitting in a Mumbai or a Delhi or a Bangalore may find it difficult to comply with regulations which may have been introduced in, say, a Bengal or an Assam or a Odisha or one of the states where there is a local language. So a lot of these are areas where law of the land and compliance with the law of the land requires more than hope, because hope is not a strategy. Here, actual systems, processes are required, and it goes far beyond just a desire to be on the right side of the law.
Right, absolutely. So we'll get into the kind of compliances in just a bit. But I just want to understand. So, you know, the center has been trying to do this. They have consolidated labor laws, and they've it has come down to 6 labor codes. But labor is a concurrent subject. So it's under the state government. It's the state government's prerogative to push these reforms in their states.
So labor is a concurrent subject. Like you said, there were 44 central labor acts, 15 were repealed. So currently we are dealing with about 29 central labor acts. In 2019 and 2020, Parliament passed 4 labor codes. That's a minor modification to the number 6. Mm-hmm. These 29 central labor acts were subsumed under the 4 labor codes. Union government has already notified its regulations in a draft stage. It has still not been implemented. Based on the union laws, states have gone ahead. Majority of them have all notified from a draft stage perspective these regulations, these laws. They are yet to become implemented. And we are hoping that as soon as the new government takes power, we see some action in that space.
So any specific states, Rishi, that have done better than the others when it comes to reforming their labor codes and labor laws to make it more conducive for industry to come and set shop? And any states that you think are the worst offenders in this?
So just to put numbers in context, Shweta, there are 4 or 5 states which are looking to become a $1 trillion economy each. You know, Maharashtra is one of them, Gujarat is another, Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Uttar Pradesh. Mm-hmm. These are some states which are talking about becoming a $1 trillion economy. Recently, we did have a chance to interact with labor officials, commissioners, minister in the state of Uttar Pradesh, and we can see they have done some really good work in that space. There's clearly a goal in front of all the officers that the state has to attract capital, foreign direct investment. It has to create jobs, and whatever is required to be done to alleviate the pain of complying with the labor laws, removing duplication, removing overlap and redundancies should be done. So while outcomes do take some time, but we have seen good intentions in the state of Karnataka. We have seen some good action. Maharashtra was taking some action. So I think incremental actions have been there, but they have been in the context of the current labor laws. However, codes will take over soon, as soon as they are implemented. And once codes take over, then I think a lion's share of the work would already have been done.
So what changes after the codes take over? Why is it that, I was speaking with some MSME owners and they are not very keen for these labor laws to be implemented. So who does it benefit? Does it benefit the labor? Does it benefit the industry?
It benefits actually both. It does not benefit the inspector in between, where we always say that in 1991, reform saw the end of license Raj, but the inspector Raj has continued. Correct. So it benefits actually both MSMEs that you're speaking to probably don't have a deeper insight into why these codes were created, what were the benefits for them also. Just so you know, right, about 30% of India's acts and rules are labor laws, but 47% of the total compliances come from labor laws, And a whopping 68% of the criminality embedded in India's compliance ecosystem comes from the labor laws, in the current labor laws. When you look at numbers, among the 69,233, about 32,000 of these compliances come from the labor laws. Guess what will be the number once the codes go through? These numbers are likely to come down by 70 to 90%, give or take. So once the final notification happens, we will do a recomputation, and we think anywhere from 70 to 80% reduction is a very nominal reduction that we are expecting to see. Now imagine a 32,000 number coming down to more like 3, 4,000, 5,000 kind of a number is a significant reduction from a rationalization of labor loss perspective. So employers should be happy.
Absolutely.
So employers should be happy.
So yeah, so to break it down, now with the new labor codes, what happens to minimum wage? What happens to working hours? What happens to living conditions, occupational and safety health? Does it increase the compliances on the part of businesses? Does that happen? Is there better sense of security, social security for labor?
In fact, the compliance burden comes down dramatically. I mean, if you look at the number of licenses, registrations, returns, and registers that need to be maintained, under the current labor laws, there are far more registrations than in the new codes. Under the current labor laws, there are multiple returns and hundreds of registers. In fact, one MSME has to deal with about 48 different unique registers in the current labor laws. In the new labor codes, we think about five registers will be good enough. Of course, depending on which state they are operating and so on and so forth. Because a lot of duplication, redundancy, and overlap has been taken care of in the new labor codes. I'll give you an example. If you look at registers on salary, or salary register as they say, there are at least 10 to 13 different formats of salary register in the current labor laws, where a Minimum Wages Act, a Payment of Wages Act, a Payment of Bonus Act, an Equal Remuneration Act, a Factories Act, Contract Labor Regulation and Abolition Act, Building and Other Construction Worker Act. All of these are examples of acts. Under each one of them, there are specific formats for wage register. Now, after all, wage is a wage. And in how many different formats can the same department ask you to keep wage register? In the new labor codes, all of that has been simplified into a single register, a single format of the register.
Okay.
So technically, technically, the 13 different registers now comes down to one. Same thing with the muster rolls, leave and attendance register, where there are 8 or 9 different formats under the different acts. Under the new labor code, there'll be only one format. Accident register. Can you believe that today there are 4 or 5 different formats of accident register under different acts? Now it will be consolidated into one. All of these are examples in which government has done an excellent job in rationalizing the number of compliances, the type of compliances, the overlaps, the duplication, the redundancy in the existing labor laws, with a very clear intention that we want to hold the employer accountable, but at the same time, we don't want an employer to go on a wild goose chase trying to just fill paperwork.
So tell me, these labor codes, these new labor laws will be uniform across states, or the states will have to notify them in their respective geographies?
The framework of the law is that the union government will create the code and union government will notify rules around the code. State governments will have to work in the structure of the code and notify their own specific rules. And then there are certain thresholds that they can breach and certain thresholds they can't touch. So, for example, there's a national minimum wage, which is a floor price determined by the national government, which is the union government. And states can set any minimum wage as long as it does not breach the floor wage. So that's an example where states have certain degree of autonomy, but it also provides standardization with certain amount of freedom to the states in order to maintain specific things which are local and adapted to the local environment.
Okay. So do the new labor codes increase minimum wage? Do they stipulate a set number of working hours? Do they make it mandatory for better occupational safety and health, equipment, all of that? Does this address all these issues?
Absolutely. I mean, nothing negative is there for the employee. Instead of 13 or many different definitions of an employee, the new labor codes create one definition. It brings supervisors and managers under the purview of an employee, which was not there in the past. Overtime regulations come into effect for senior people, including supervisors and managerial staff as well. National floor.
one quick question. So this means, so do these labor laws or do these new labor codes in cover all aspects of employment, or is it only for blue collar jobs and it's restricted to that?
No, it covers all aspects of employment. Every single aspect around employment, which is currently prescribed in 29 central labor acts, has been now subsumed under the four codes. It includes all kinds of staff, including workers, blue-collared workers, as well as the white-collared workers.
Okay. So now,
it's just that the white-collared workers will not have a minimum wage, for example, because minimum wage is to make sure the lower side of the wage can be protected. White-collared workers typically are paid higher than the minimum wage. So those kind of compliances, while available in the law, are not practical in application for white-collared workers.
Sure, sure. So let's just talk about why is this such a politically contentious issue? And India has been talking about reforming its labor laws for a really long time, but it's not been able to make progress at the same pace. And like I told you, even industry is not for it. Industry is also resisting it. And what we'd heard was that this could be a priority for the new government in the first 100 days, depending on the number of seats they win. It totally depends on the kind of... So what are the political, do we expect a lot of... do we expect a lot of ruffling of feathers if labor laws are implemented, and specifically in states like Bengal and, Uttar Pradesh?
So, very interesting question, and let me see if I can answer it politically correctly. Just to put the context here, 9% of India's labor force benefits from the current labor laws, because the remaining 91% is either in the unorganized sector or does not have any direct benefit of an ESIC or a PF or any one of the Minimum Wages Act or Payment of Wages, Payment of Bonus or Factories Act. Does not benefit 91% of India's labor force. If you see in the recent times, our economy has changed and we have seen a lot of delivery boys, whether it is a food delivery, it's the e-commerce delivery, we have seen a lot of, urban transportation companies like Ola and Uber and their drivers, all of these workers fall under a category of gig workers. Now, while gig workers do the work, and they contribute very productively to the economy, but unfortunately, they don't have one employer. That employer is not bound to a minimum wage. They don't get any health benefits. They don't get any retirement benefits. They don't get any provident fund. They are not creating savings for their retirement when they are unable to perform the physical work and so on and so forth. The new labor codes brings in capabilities to have a framework, and we are yet to see how that framework will look like, but there is clearly an intent to address the home-based workers, the part-time workers, the gig workers, and so on and so forth in the new labor laws. So the one of the ideas, like the tax base, we've always spoken about a small number of taxpayers responsible for the entire direct tax burden of the economy. Here also, the whole idea is how do you increase the size of the population of working class who benefits from the labor laws. So one of the key intentions...
Is it a bit like the farm laws, where the middleman was benefiting and made sure that the farm laws were stalled? So like you just said, that only 9% benefit from the current labor laws. But it's a very powerful
law. When labor unions talk about protecting the interest of the labor class, they're actually talking about the 9%. Nobody represents the other 91% in the economy. Now, you mentioned, will it be government's first agenda? Absolutely. In my opinion, if India has to become a manufacturing hub, become a center for attracting the China refugees, attract that capital, become to the factory to the world, because as Honorable Prime Minister says, we are in the middle of Amrit Kal. The next 20, 30 years, we will have a demographic dividend. While the Europe and America will have more mouths to feed than hands to work, India will have far more hands to work. How do we leverage the demographic dividend is by moving a lot of jobs from farm into manufacturing. And if we have to create a lot of manufacturing jobs, labor laws become a binding constraint. So we have to figure out a way in which the laws are reformed in such a way that labor benefits and the industry benefits, the current beneficiary, to your earlier point, is basically the inspector in between, who has so much power that they can just show up, they can inspect anyone, they can write anyone up. You know, the kind of rudimentary items that people get written for in many cases, they're not the kind of stuff that we should be doing in 21st century India. But if you would like, I can give you some examples of the kind of laws that we deal with. But, you know, do you want some examples?
Yes, absolutely. We're running out of time, but yes, please, let's sure. include some examples. Yeah.
So under the Factories Act of 1948, the factory requires adequate number of places to provide clean drinking water, provide 5 liters of drinking water to every worker. It talks about spittoons. Now, in this day and age, you know, our labor laws, which were written in 1948, right after the time we became independent, still provide provision for spittoon. For those of your viewers who don't understand spittoon in English, it is thukdan. So right. In 1948, maybe this was a good idea to provide a spittoon. Today, it is not, because companies like biotech manufacturing, pharma manufacturing, many other manufacturing companies are state of the art. They are dust free. They are temperature controlled, humidity controlled. They are air conditioned. You can't find a speck of dust. How can you allow people to spit? But there is a provision for providing the spittoons under the labor laws. There are provisions for whitewashing of latrines. Now imagine a scenario where chuna lagana was a common thing in 1940s. Today, everybody has a ceramic lined toilet all the way to the top. Right, but our labor laws still require us to lagao chuna on the walls. So I'm just giving you examples of the...
How about you share some examples with us for some of the sunrise sectors, for instance, pharmaceuticals, the kind of compliances they have, because we're trying to become like the pharmaceutical factory for the world, and the kind of compliances that companies are having to deal with. Just give us a little overview of that.
So pharma is a sector. There are two kinds of compliances for every sector. One of them is industry specific compliance, where the Drug and Cosmetic Act and many other pharma related acts come in. There is no harm in having those kinds of controls, because we don't want manufacturers to be manufacturing medicines where Absolutely. There is no control on quality and stuff. But the other aspects of manufacturing, like I said, provision of a spittoon is an example of a Factories Act compliance, which is applicable to a pharma company. Now, can you imagine a pharma company in India today where in the shop floor they can provide a spittoon? The answer is no. Today,
and if
there is a war.
Can they provide a spittoon? Can they be imprisoned or they're imposed a fine, a big fine for that?
Of course. The spittoon is an important compliance, as an example, under the Factories Act of 1948, contravention of which has provisions for a variety of provisions. So, I'm just giving you one example. Failing to whitewash the inner walls of latrine used by a contractor once every 4 months has a clause for imprisonment, as an example. Now, who wants to whitewash or lime wash a latrine today? They are ceramic lined. There are specific provisions on the number of urinals in the male toilet that you need to provide in the factory. Now, these are all microscopic prescriptions, may have been relevant at a time when India's labor laws were primarily applicable to a minuscule chunk of private sector. There was no private sector, hardly any private sector in 1948. All of it was public sector. All jobs were getting created in public sector. India's socio-economic demographic fabric was very different as compared to today. Now, what percentage of India's investment today comes from public sector versus look at foreign direct investment, look at repatriation, look at new jobs being created in the private sector. Our laws have to keep pace with the way the world is moving rather than...
Absolutely. And currently, considering India is right now pitching itself to the world, we are looking at getting Tesla to set shop. We've got Foxconn here making phones, iPhones for the world out of India. India really, just to go back to our conversation, India really needs to upgrade its labor laws to ensure that India indeed becomes a factory for the world. Thank you so much, Rishi, for this perspective. Of course, we'll keep tracking the story as it develops, and let's hope that this indeed is a part of the government's 100-day agenda. This is all we have on this episode of Political Economy with Shweta Punj. Of course, we'll be back next week, and a big thank you to all our viewers for tuning in. Do leave your comments and send us your feedback. Thanks so much for watching.